Happy heresies, and welcome to the Desert of the Real. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your pompous of Gnosis, that ubic spray to take away that smell of colitas rising up through the air of a world gone mad. And yes, this is a special presentation, as you probably know. It's a piece of content that I have wanted to put out for a while, but, you know, in the game of Saturn and the shenanigans of the Archons, it just hasn't happened until now, but it is spring, so it is the time of the goddess of Persephone and her friends to rise up. And this goddess in this presentation is the Gnostic Thunder Perfect Mind. I have contended before that Nerea in the Gnostic text is the most unique heroine in all of comparative religion. Now I contend that Thunder is the most unique goddess in all of religion. But let me know your thoughts. I gave this presentation at the Finding Hermes group a while ago, and now it's for thee. I think you will find her very interesting, especially beyond classical Gnosticism and her powerful message, how she has manifested throughout history, including secretly in the works of John Dee, in Thelema, and even in the imagination of Ridley Scott. As always, non-subs will get the full presentation, whether you're on audio or video, but for all subs, you're going to get some cool bonuses. One of them is the Q&A that we did afterwards, which is very engaging. The other will be an interview I did with academic Hal Tosic. He wrote the book Thunder, and Celine Lilly is one of the authors of the book too. It is a scholarly book, so it's very expensive, even if his book on Thunder is probably the definitive source for this topic, for the goddess. But don't worry, our interview really covers everything. As a further bonus, I will have a clip with the Bible geek Robert Price, where he also discusses his ideas on Thunder. And lastly, a clip with John Turner on his ideas on Thunder. Blessed be his memory, and without a doubt, John was and will always be probably the main source and expert when it comes to any Gnostic thought. For all ya subs, this is like a mini course on Thunder, and it will bring a lot of insights on the divine feminine in Gnosticism. It will truly expand your historical and intellectual capabilities or knowledge, if you would. And as you will see in the presentation, it can also really help your spiritual life as I provide exercises on how you can incorporate Thunder and the Gnostic goddess into your own praxis. As always, please support this heresy if you can. This presentation is found in the Virtual Alexandria Academy, but I also have about 30 other presentations or courses, if you would, on all things Gnostics, from Gnostic texts, figures, sects, and how Gnosticism has manifested throughout history. It's a place to be, indeed. Or you can join the Finding Hermes group, where we meet twice a month, one for a very engaging Q&A, and the other for a presentation on Gnostic spirituality, practice, or just intricate history, if you would. Usually done by me or sometimes by another guest. You can also, if you want to support, you can provide a one-time donation, or you can support at my Amazon wish list, or even buy the Gnostic Tarot. Many ways to keep the lights of the Pleroma here at Aeon Byte. Let's get on to my presentation, and I hope you truly hear the voice of Thunder when we are done. Thanks. All right. Welcome, everybody, officially to the Finding Hermes presentation, the Gnostic Praxis, Ritual, and Healing part of our monthly meetings, our bi-monthly meetings. Thanks, everybody, for showing up. And I'm very excited about tonight because this is one of my favorite texts. And I think it's one of the most important texts out there. And that is Thunder Perfect Mind. I would say that this mysterious text and certainly this enigmatic female protagonist giving us this beautiful and tragic and ethereal prose is has really resonated. Some scholars have said that this is the most beautiful poem, one of the most beautiful poem in the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. And it is, we can say, it is a very old poem. Somebody who agrees with this is Willis Barnstone, who's the great translator, and along with Marvin Meyer are the two forces behind the Gnostic Bible. So this is an important text, and we're going to find out about its history, its impact, and how it can even help you with your own spirituality, as it undoubtedly helped the ancient Gnostics with their spirituality. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about its impact so you can get some perspective. It is very popular in Western occultism, and it's actually very popular even in mainstream art. On the top right, you will see a picture of a woman, and that is from a Prada commercial from 2005. And it's basically 8 minutes with a narrator speaking or talking, basically doing Thunder Perfect Mind, narrating the text with a woman going across the city on her adventures to parties, to shopping, to music halls. You hear this sultry jazz music in the background. And it's a pretty awesome commercial. I would definitely check it out. There are many, versions, but just go to YouTube and type in Prada commercial Thunder. And it's about 8 minutes long. And what's interesting about this Prada commercial is that the mind behind it is none other than Ridley Scott. He's the one who gave us this Gnostic Prada fashion commercial. And Ridley Scott is certainly tied to many occult esoteric ideas and movies and so forth. So when it comes to movies, as you can see in the bottom right, that is from the Netflix show Fedia. And this came out this year. Fedia, and I have quoted the show, I have talked about this show. It is basically your typical, you might say, almost, stereotypical movie where there is a small town, and on the outskirts of town, there is an evil cult. But instead of the usual evil cult being sort of a Crowley or Lovecraftian caricature, the evil cult is a Gnostic cult. Yes, for some reason, this Gnostic cult wants to summon Yaldabaoth to this plane. It's almost silly, but it's a really fascinating show, and certainly check it out if you have Netflix. But this, as they use some of the Nag Hammadi library text to do their magic, they certainly quote and talk about Thunder Perfect Mind. When it comes to literature, you find Thunder the Perfect Mind in Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum. Foucault's Pendulum, I would call it the thinking man, Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code. It is exploration and speculation on conspiracy theories and alternative history. And it has everything that the Da Vinci Code has and much more, but very highbrow, very philosophical, and very experimental. There is one chapter where Umberto Eco quotes Thunder Perfect Mind, and even discusses the text. If you get a chance, certainly check out Foucault's Pendulum on Audible, because it is narrated by none other than Tim Curry. Yes, Dr. Frankenfurter from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the butler from Clue, and Pennywise from the It TV series narrates it, and he does a damn fine job. Continuing in literature, we find Thunder Perfect Mind in Toni Morrison's Jazz. She also quotes Thunder Perfect Mind and dedicates some of her chapters to this text. Toni Morrison, I feel, writes some of the best prose in history. I would put her prose up there with Ernest Hemingway and other great writers. She's just simply amazing. Now, you can find Thunder Perfect Mind, other bands have, oh, speaking of music, I just skipped the music. Yes, you can find Thunder Perfect Mind in a lot of bands, from heavy metal to pop, but probably the most famous one is Current 93, who is really the artist David Tibet. And he has an album, or the band Who Is He has an album entitled Thunder Perfect Mind, came out also probably around 2005 or so. And David is certainly influenced by Thelema and other occultism, but he is heavily influenced by Gnosticism and other Christian mysticism. But again, there are other places where you find Thunder Perfect Mind, but I thought I'd give you a nice snapshot of how she is appearing in our popular culture today, even as she's very popular with occultists today. Now, even before we get into the text, this I would like to share from an email that Hall Tosig sent me. Hall Tosig was a guest. He and Celine Lilly wrote a book with other scholars called Thunder, the Perfect Mind Translations. It's an excellent book. Hal did an interview with me on AM Byte. I would check it out. But we went back and forth in some emails, and he told me that there are three interpretations of thunder that you can keep in mind, and they're all equal and they're all valid. He said, one, you can approach it as a netherworld of weirdness. Two, you can approach it as a dualistic feminism. Three, you can approach it as a poetic, semi-divine addressing of violence and loss. Hal himself falls under the third one. That's the one he approaches it. And it is interesting because Hal is he's retired now, but he was a Methodist minister. He has a PhD, but he's a minister. In other words, he is a very conservative Christian. He's no friend of the Gnostics, but as a scholar, as he was doing research in early Christianity, he realized that there was a huge wisdom tradition that had basically been overlooked or suppressed. And he said, look, this is where the data is taking me. This is how early Christianity started. So he wrote a lot of books on the wisdom tradition in early Christianity and some in Judaism. And eventually he gave us the great book, Thunder Perfect Mind, the Translations, which again, he co-wrote with past guest Celine Lilly. Hal also told me in the interview on AM Byte that what we need is about, 14 or 15 more translations, because with each translation, you get a new insight or revelation or something opens up to the cultural milieu around the text, and you find just bigger dimensions on this text. And believe it or not, there are far more translations of the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, or the Secret Book of John than there are translations of Thunder Perfect Mind. And you'll see in a few slides how these translations, these tweaks, or these discoveries can make a big difference in the theology and history of the text. So let me know which of the three you might see yourself going down or adopting. And remember, there is no wrong answer. So let's get into the background and genre of thunder. And again, this is a very fascinating text. Thunder Perfect Mind is found in the Nag Hammadi Library Codex 6, second slot. It is not found anywhere else but in the Nag Hammadi Library. The first time anybody saw it was, yes, well, it was discovered in 1945, but the English translation only came out around in 1979. And this is important for a little bit down the line of this presentation, as you shall see. It is probably of Egyptian origin. The protagonist, Thunder, does mention Egypt. So I would say most scholars are in agreement. It is an Egyptian text. The dating, while there is differences in opinion on this, most scholars put it between the 2nd century to the early 4th century. Although in his book, Hal Tosig does say that there are scholars who put it as early as 300 BC. Why is that? Well, as you will see, it seems to be a non-Christian text. So there have been scholars who have put it as more or less a Judo-pagan text. I myself put it probably around early first century, simply because I see it as a sort of a developing Sophianic tradition that isn't, I don't want to say mature, but you might say complex as it would become under the hands of the Sethians and the Valentinians and others. But we'll explore this a little bit more. But right now there is no total agreement. The agreement for sure is that, yes, we do have a Coptic translation in the Nag Hammadi Library, but it was probably originally written in Greek. The genre the genre is in agreement by most that it is an eratology. An eratology is a poetic monologue celebrating the deeds and powers of a god. Others, and you also could easily say this is also a wisdom monologue, as the protagonist in Thunder gives advice and views and insights very much, like the wisdom tradition, like the Gospel of Thomas or the Sentences of Sextus, but it is a wisdom figure speaking to an audience, and this wisdom figure, without a doubt, is divine in nature. For examples of eratologies, probably the most famous one we have is the Metamorphoses, or the Golden Ass, as Augustine called it, written by Apuleius. This ancient text has the protagonist, Lucius, who's sort of a dorky magician who has a problem with one of his magical experiments and turns himself into a donkey. He makes an ass out of himself. Ha ha ha. And the story is of him going around as a donkey. And most have said this text, the Metamorphoses, is a satire because Lucius is a donkey, sees humans do all these evil deeds and selfish actions and all that simply because people don't know he was a human and still can think like a human. So scholars have said, and literary critics, that it is a satire. However, others have said it is a mystery religion. It's a hidden mystery religion text because at the end, what you have is, at the end, what you have is that the goddess Isis appears and gives this wonderful speech, this declaration of her power and her deeds and all the good that she is and that she's done. And she says she's the midnight sun and all that. And eventually she turns Lucius back into the human. But some have said that Apuleius is actually hiding mystery prayers and rituals in this text, because in those days, remember, if you gave away anything about the mysteries, you would get killed, both legally and by somebody. You just didn't give away the mystery religions, and the Metamorphoses might be a coded message about the mysteries of Isis. But in any event, it is an eratology. Now, Isis, The other famous eritology of Isis that I wanted to show as an example, and that is the Syme eritology. And this was, this text is probably from the first century. It was found in Turkey. And again, it is Isis basically saying that she is awesome, basically. Not even basically, for truth. Let me read it for you. Here she says, "I am Isis, absolute leader of every land. I establish laws for human beings. I separated earth from heaven. I revealed the path of the stars. I coordinated the path of sun and moon. I made justice strong. I brought together wife and husband. I am master of thunder. I defeat fate. Fate obeys me." And even there, and as you notice, she does mention the word thunder. So there is a connection with thunder, perfect mind. There's another part I was reading today where she says, "I am the queen of the thunderbolt." And she's very much also connecting her to the sort of Gnostic goddess. She talks about defeating fate, how fate obeys her, because obviously the Gnostics, one of their big obsessions was the destruction of fate and the mastery of all the planets and the stars. So you see, this is Isis already in the first century. She has long left her role as sort of this fertility Egyptian goddess. And in the Greco-Roman time, she is a creatrix, supreme mother like Sabel, and really almost a supreme goddess, as you can see. And this eritology is actually very, the eritologies of Isis are pretty similar to that of thunder. So why don't we take a look at some of the text of thunder. This is the beginning, and I shall read it to you so you can get a sense of it. "I was sent forth from the power, and I have come to those who reflect upon me, and I have been found among those who seek after me. Look upon me, you who reflect upon me, and you hear me. You who are waiting for me, take me to yourselves, and do not banish me from your sight. And do not make your voice hate me, nor your hearing. Do not be ignorant of me anywhere or any time. Be on your guard. Do not be ignorant of me. For I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter. I am the members of my mother. I am the barren one. And many are her sons." And the rest of the poem is really beautiful and powerful. Now, as you can see, there are similarities to Isis and other deities. However, there is a big difference, and I'm sure many of you can see it here. But in all eritologies by ancient deities, they talk about their positive aspects, their positive features, how great they are. This diverges big time because thunder is not only mentioned her positive aspects and deeds, but she's also mentioning her negative aspects and deeds too, in a very sort of paradoxical, contradictory, dualistic way. You can see it right here. She is also, she is the scorned one as she is the honored one. She is holy, but she's also a whore. She is the barren one, and so forth. And here she's saying, "Don't scorn me, don't leave me," and so forth. If you look at the rest of the text, there are scenes where she is being really brutalized by the world, abandoned by the world, just like there are many scenes where she is really on top of the world, if you would. So this is the twist you might have in thunder. And you may ask why. Well, we're going to get to that very soon. The other thing to mention, I talked about the dating, how somebody said it could be 300 BC because it's non-Christian, and it really doesn't have any Christian features, at least not on the surface. But in a way, it might. I'm going to give some other reasons soon, but if you noticed, the I ams of thunder, especially these rhythmical ones, are kind of similar to Jesus in the Gospel of John, where he's saying, "I am this, I am that." at the same time, like thunder, Jesus is brutalized. He is persecuted. Those who follow him, the world will hate him. So you have these parallels. And at the same time, you'll see both, there is no doubt, if scholars said, that thunder is in control. She is in control and she is victorious. And Jesus, as much as bad things happen to him in the Gospel of John, he is control of the grand narrative. He knows exactly what's going to happen and exactly who he is and exactly where things are going. So it's interesting similarities with Jesus in the Gospel of John and thunder, perfect mind. Now, who could be the group or sect behind thunder? Well, there are two camps right now. The first one, you would have, yes, Hal Tosic and Dr. David Litwa. And that one says that is basically your boilerplate general cult of wisdom. It is a Christian wisdom or Judo-Christian work that is addressing Simonians, Valentinians, Sethians, and really any early Christians that see wisdom as central. And as Hal has argued, wisdom was very central to early Christianity, and it simply got overlooked, suppressed. Yeah, you know the story when it comes to these things. The other theory says that the group behind it is none other than the Sethians. This is suggested by Bentley Layton. He is the mind, along with David Brackey, behind the Gnostic scriptures, and Birger Pearson, who wrote the great book Ancient Gnosticism and is one of the very translators of the Nag Hammadi Library. Birger has been on the show, and he's great. But anyway, these two advocate for it to be Sethian. An example is that in one place in Thunder, she says, "I am the silence that is incomprehensible, and the reflection, or epinoia, whose remembrance is frequent." And they say that reflection and silence are characteristics of Bar Below, epinoia, Sophia, and the heavenly Eve. You see this over and over in the Sethian texts, regardless of the manifestation of the divine feminine. The other argument is on the Nag Hammadi libraries on the origin of the world. Eve is referred to as the first virgin, the one who is without a husband, who is life. And Eve in on the origin of the world, in fact, Sophia too, and other goddesses in these texts often will go on these I am statements like wife, virgin, midwife. It's a very Sethian characteristic, if you would, especially when you in the mouth of the manifestation of the divine feminine. So these are the arguments for it being a Sethian text versus just a general Christian wisdom text. Let's see, the other argument that gets it a little bit closer to Sethian, and it's just a very interesting feature to mention, and that is the Gospel of Eve. The Gospel of Eve, we only have this text or this quote, and it is quote by the church father Epiphanius, I believe it's the 4th century, and is Panarion. And in it, he is slamming a group of Gnostics called the Borborites. The Borborites, according to Epiphanius, were the descendants of the Nicolaitans, those kind of crazy and immortal Christians that you find that are mentioned in the Apocalypse of John or the Book of Revelation. But he also says that they're also a descendant also from the Sethians. So, and this Borborites were libertines who embraced the pleasures of the earthly world. Perhaps it's likely that the Borborites were a descendant of the Nicolaitans through the Sethians, and then eventually, well, they weren't even the Borborites, because I should mention that the Borborites is translated from Greek as filthy ones. So basically, he was saying that the Borbarites were these dirty Gnostics. So it's unlikely that the Borbarites actually call themselves Borbarites. They probably call themselves Sethians or Christians or Gnostics. But that's the name that our friend Epiphanius, the heresy hunter, calls them. The Borbarites had two texts that they followed, and those were the Gospel of Eve and also a Gospel of Perfection, which it appears we don't have. But anyway, let me quote from Epiphanius. He says, and this is from the Gospel of Eve, "I stood on a lofty mountain and saw a gigantic man and another, a dwarf. And I heard as it were a voice of thunder, and drew nigh for to hear. And he spake unto me and said, I am thou, and thou art I. And wheresoever thou mayest be, I am there. And all I am scattered, that is, the logos as seed or members. And whensoever thou willest, thou gatherest me. And gathering me, thou gatherest thyself." So as you can see, there is again this connection between wisdom and thunder, and this seems to be yet another feature or element of the Sethian tradition, which again is another argument for thunder being a Sethian work originally. Well, why don't we get into the theology and mysticism of thunder? One second, let me grab a quick water here. Because I will be quoting a lot for you. But now I mentioned that she was different than Isis, and that is because the Gnostics were drawing from, yes, they were drawing from the Hebrew wisdom tradition. And in the Hebrew wisdom tradition, well, things don't go very well for wisdom. Wisdom has a lot of problems, even though she is supreme. And let me give you some examples here. From the book of Enoch, chapter 42, it says, "Wisdom went forth to make her dwelling among the children of men, and found no dwelling place. Wisdom returned to her place and took her seat among the angels." 1 Enoch 42, to be specific. This is from Proverbs 8:22-24 and 27. "The Lord possessed me from the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning, or ever the earth was. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he set a compass upon the face of the depth." And then let me quote from Ecclesiasticus, or the Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 24. "I came out of the mouth of the Most High and covered the earth as a cloud. I dwelt in high places, and my throne is a cloudy pillar. I alone compassed the circuit of the sky and walked into the bottom of the deep, in the waves of the sea and in all the earth and in every people and nation. He created me from the beginning, before the world, and I shall never fail." So you see this over and over in other places. You see this sort of supreme being, can we say the first thought of God or first power of God, who helps with the world, but somehow she is scorned. She is rejected. You find it in later Jewish tradition, like the Zohar and the Talmud, an example where the Shekinah is portrayed as this princess locked outside the gates, or sometimes a princess that is in a tower with a veil and you have to sort of rescue her. Or in, for example, she is when the Romans destroyed the second temple, the Shekinah had no home and she demands that her husband Yahweh built her new temple. Now, obviously, the Shekinah is actually a Shira, we can tell, but regardless, you find in Jewish tradition this powerful goddess who is scorned by humans and other deities, and basically for the world to be better, she has to be restored. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, we all want wisdom, but wisdom is the one thing that humans reject over and over and over again, even today. So the Hebrews certainly had it right, unlike the other religions. I should mention, and again, I'm going to repeat this, she is all powerful, like ISIS. She is in control. Bad things have happened, but she's got it going, and things are, they're going her way. And you see this sort of motif that of the Hebrew wisdom so prevalent in Gnostic literature. You see it, well, you see it in Thunder Perfect Mind, right? But you see it in the exegesis of the soul, where the soul is portrayed as feminine and she falls into the world and she's grabbed by these angels and raped and beaten. You see it also in the Nag Hammadi Library's Trimorphic Pretanoia, although in this one, she's pretty much supreme. I don't think she even rescues Jesus from the cross in the crucifixion, but she likes to go into these I am things and it's almost like her against the universe. You see it obviously in the Simonian myth, where the first thought of God is captured by these greedy angels who want to rule the world. She's cast down into the world and thrown into flesh, and she reincarnates throughout history until God takes the material form of a man in Simon Magus and finds her, Ellen of Tyre. And when they reunite, that's when you have the great hierogamos, the bridal chamber, the full union of all opposite. So this theme you find over and over in Gnosticism, and you find the theme again that wisdom will be victorious. And God, I hope so. God, I hope so, Yahweh Nashira, because we need her more than ever. So I think that's it. Now, what are some characteristics or features or elements that we find in Thunder Perfect Mind? One that is obvious is that she stands outside normal structures. She is definitely at the edges of town. She is definitely the outsider playing Dungeons and Dragons with the kids and Stranger Things. She is on the margins. She is subversive. That is what wisdom is in the Gnostic and Hebrew dispensation. But she also speaks to everyone, even the barbarian, and she says it. Her call is to everyone. It doesn't matter what race, what gender, what position you have. In society, in this poem, you see her just calling and calling to everybody. Anybody who wants to hear her voice will hear it, who needs it, and they will be, well, they will have the presence of the goddess herself. The other thing that's interesting, remember when I said that we need many translations of Thunder? Well, in one of the translation, and I believe that was actually Celine Lilly who did the translation, but she, there is some gender bending. In other words, there is, for example, in one part, it says, I am the mother, but he is also nurturing, or something. In other words, the she's are changed to he's. And for a long time, translators thought, well, this is a scribal error. But Celine Lilly says, no, it's not a scribal error. This is gender bending. This is going to the famous or notorious, if you would, for some individuals, the Gnostic idea of transcending, the Gnostic idea that you go above and can encompass all polarities into unified superior being. This is the idea of the Adam Kadmon, the primal man, the holy hermaphrodite that you find in Plato. And this is a prevalent idea in Gnosticism. For example, you have in the Secret Book of John, when Jesus appears to the Apostle John after his resurrection, he takes all these shapes in front of the Apostle John, and one of the shapes is of a woman, of a nurturing mother. You find in the Sethian myth, Barbalo, as she is the expression of the invisible spirit, the first thought, one of her characteristics is the father. She is total. She joins in all polarities. So this is probably a reason why, and of course you may have your own reasons, this is one of the reasons why you have this gender bending in some of the latest translations of Thunder. Now, the interesting that Hal Tosic mentioned to me, and remember, Paul is a conservative, retired Methodist minister, but he knows where the data goes. And he says that Paul does his own gender bending. For example, in 1 Corinthians 2, that's sort of the famous speech where Paul is talking about the wisdom of this world that's false. And basically, the Valentinians took it that that was Achamoth, the wisdom of death, the evil wisdom or corrupt wisdom. But then he talks about the wisdom of God. He goes into the speech about how Jesus was crucified and died. And then he connects the wisdom of God. He connects Sophia to Jesus. He says Sophia is Jesus. Now, according to Hal, in the first century, there was no doubt that Sophia was female. So basically, Paul himself is doing some gender bending by making Jesus female. The other thing I wanted to mention, no, more like a repeat, is again, she's a powerful goddess. She's in control. She is scorned by the world, angels and humans. She is a creatrix. She is abandoned. She keeps getting abandoned by those who need her. She's rejected, and ultimately she is a savior, like the trimorphic pretanoia, like Sophia, like Eve. She is a savior deity, like Isis, for sure. The last characteristic is that it is performative. And yes, I don't think that's a surprise. If this is a very passionate, emotional poem, I would say that, yes, it was, and it's one narrator. It was probably one person in front of a crowd, and you just had to go for it. In fact, the clue that it is performative is that this is from Nicola Denze-Lewis' excellent book, Introduction to Gnosticism. And I highly recommend the book because it is an introductory text, but she has a lot of amazing charts that gives you a good view of the Sethians and the Valentinians and the timing of these texts. But in one of them, she breaks down Thunder the Perfect Mind of what the structure is. And I wish I had a better picture, but I used my phone to get this. But as you can see, there is a structure. You've got the introduction, which I read, then the I sayings, then you got B, the questions, then more I saying, exhortations, cautions, and you can see there is a rhythm. So whoever had to learn this poem probably had to know what the structures were, and these structures, then it was a lot easier to be able to perform this play. So maybe you can even, when you read Thunder, you can break it down and find some things for yourself. All right. So yes, it was definitely performative. All right. As always, I like to get into some radical scholarship, or I don't even want to call it radical, alternative, or just very cool scholarship. But one of them has to do with Revelation, or the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse of John. And this is from Robert Price. You can find his translation and commentary in his book, The Pre-Nicene New Testament. However, he very nicely allowed me to reprint it at the website. So you have the address there if you want to check it out, translation and full commentary. But anyway, Robert says, and I quote, "A giant angel stands like the Colossus of Rhodes astride land and sea. He roars like a lion, and seven thunderous voices answer him with some articulate revelation. As the narrator begins to transcribe it, when he is finished, the angel directs him not to destroy it. Neither had he told him not to write it down in the first place, but to seal it up, just as Daniel 12:9-10 had once been instructed by an angel to seal up his prophecy till the generation for those sake it was written should appear. It would not make sense to anyone till then, and then only to the wise. In light of this, we must assume that there was some sort of apocalypse of the seven thunders in circulation, and that the writer of Revelation was concerned that readers, especially the Nicolaitans, were drawing dangerous inferences from it, a la 2 Peter 3. Thus he wants to shut the book and withdraw it from circulation. That book was Thunder Perfect Mind. So Bob is basically, we're going to the Nicolaitans again, and Bob is saying that, yes, this book that needed to be sealed up of Thunder was Thunder the Perfect Mind. And remember, a little earlier, I did say that the Borborites, the descendants of the Nicolaitans and the Sethians, they use the Gospel of Eve as well as the Gospel of Perfection. Bob thinks that the Gospel of Perfection was, yes, Thunder Perfect Mind. So this is a fascinating, fascinating theory or hypothesis. The other one, which is just as fascinating, is that, yes, it was written by a woman. As Nicola Danze Lewis herself says in the book Introduction to Gnosticism, it is difficult to imagine a male prophet or teacher standing before a community and reciting this text. And I wrote all about this and more about this argument in Silent No More, Gnostic and Orthodox Gospels Written by Women. There is a link if you want to check it out. There's more evidence of this. And there is also evidence of other texts written by women. And it's really not that crazy to think about it, especially Thunder the Perfect Mind, which is a very androcentric text. Yes, yes, I know the argument is that wisdom speaks through everybody, right? Wisdom can speak through a child, through an animal, through a person. Wisdom isn't interested in genders, but I think there is something very feminine about Thunder, and I don't know if you could have some a la Monty Python guy standing there dressed and reciting this and really hit his audience. The article is also very interesting. I don't think this is a side note, but the other argument, for example, in this article is that a text like On the Origin of the World is written by a woman. And this argument is done by Andrew Philip Smith. He says that if you look at all the metaphors and the symbols and the imagery of On the Origin of the World, it's all about menstrual blood and birth blood and the pangs of being born. And oh, it's a really prevalent theme in On the Origin of the World. So Andrew says it just makes sense that this would have come from the mind of a woman. The other one, too, that might surprise you, and this is an argument by Stephen Davis, is that the Gospel of Luke was written by a woman. Why is that? Because he says that of all the four Gospels, this one you get just women being introduced, and women just dominate a lot of the time and the real estate in this Gospel. So maybe Luke was originally written by a woman. Robert Price disagrees because he says, yes, we have a lot of women in the Gospel of Luke, but they're always bad things happen to them, or they're marginalized, or they're made look like fools. My argument is that, you know, in the canonical Gospels, all apostles look like fools, right? I mean, they don't get the parables of Jesus. They don't know it's Jesus. They betray him. All apostles fall short, and I would say, except for Mary Magdalene, maybe even women apostles. So these are interesting theories. And again, I don't think it would be even that rare. I mean, just recently, I did the interview with Dr. David Litwa. He talked about Marcellina, who was a prevalent and successful Christian leader in Rome in the second century, had her own church. We have talked about, obviously, movements and gospels written on Mary Magdalene. Salome makes it in a lot of these gospels. As you know, or as I have mentioned, the Mandeans claim that they were founded by a woman named Mary. Same with the Nassines. They said they were founded by a woman named Mary, who was a disciple of James the Just. As Joanna herself has mentioned, we have Mary the Jew, who is perhaps one of the foundational figures of alchemy. So she definitely had to write stuff, math and other things. So even Paul, what does Paul say? He says that women must prophesy in church. So he's saying that if the Spirit reaches a woman, she should be able to express the voice of God and the voice of the angels. So the idea of a woman writing a gospel or performing a gospel, you know, in Gnostic circles, it would not be rare. In fact, I would, if I was a betting man, I would say that certainly a lot of women probably wrote some of these works in ancient times. No doubt about it. All right. The other interesting theory or hypothesis, this comes from Jason Louv and his great book, Empire of Angels. And he is, and this is not only his idea, others have mentioned this, and we are traveling forward in time, many centuries to the 16th century, to the year 1587 with Edward Kelly and John Dee, famous for using this Aztec black mirror to scry and talk to angelic forces from above. But there is one instance where they were having trouble contacting angels, and this angel had this strange idea that they should do some wife swapping, and the two fools obeyed, and yes, they did some wife swapping. And after that incident, this being called the Daughter of Fortitude appeared to them. This being was described as, quote, like beaten gold, she hath on her forehead a cross crystal line, her neck and breast sere bare unto under her dugs. She had a girdle of beaten gold slack buckled unto her, with a pendant of gold down to the ground. And this Daughter of Fortitude starts giving these exhortations, these declarations, and they are eerily similar to Thunder Perfect Mind. Here's just one example. The Daughter of Fortitude says, I am a harlot for such as ravish me, and a virgin with such as know me not. And then Thunder says in Thunder Perfect Mind, I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. And you've over and over, you find these similarities. And again, remember I said that Thunder Perfect Mind is only found in the Nag Hammadi Library. No church father, no theologian has ever mentioned it throughout history until it was discovered in the Nag Hammadi Library in 1945. So there is no way that John Dee and Edward Kelly would have known about it. John Dee was a scholar with a large library. I'm sure, let's say he'd gotten a hold of a copy, he would have told the world, he would have told Queen Elizabeth about such a momentous discovery. So this is a fascinating theory. Now we go to the Mandeans, and here it also gets very interesting too. In Mandean lore, there is this passage from Book 6 from the Book of Dinanuk of the Rite Ginza. And Dinanuk is this god who looks like a book with the head of a human, and he's always reading himself. He's the great representation of the logos of knowledge, the Akashic records. He is just live, living knowledge. But in one part, the goddess Ruha appears to Dinanuk. Now, Ruha is the Mandean, well, it's Hebrew for spirit, but she is obviously associated with Sophia and the Holy Spirit. However, the Mandeans did the Gnostic turn, which they turned Ruha into a demon. As you can, that's why I have this picture. The Mandeans had no patience for Sophia waiting around, so they made her the bad guy in her stories. They did the same with Jesus, saying he was a false prophet, and made John the Baptist as the primary good guy of those days. But anyway, Ruha appears to Dinanuk and says, I am the life that was from time immemorial. I am the Kusta that was before in the beginning. I am the radiance. I am the light. I am the death. I am the life. I am the darkness. I am the light. I am the error. I am the truth. I am the destruction. I am the construction. I am the blow, I am the healing, I am the exalted man who is older and was there earlier than the builder of heaven and earth. I have no comrade among kings, and there is no other crown in my kingdom. There is not a single person who could give me a notice in the misty clouds of darkness. So there's not only the gender bending, but is these paradoxical, contradictory declarations of who she is. And it should be mentioned, Ruha is victorious and all powerful. In the Mandean scriptures, she ain't going anywhere. She is part of the cosmic order, and she's going to rule hell from now until the end. So interesting. And again, I don't know if the Mendians might have had some connection to the Sethians, but very interesting. The Mendians would say this is from the first century. Most scholars put it in early medieval times, I believe. But again, there is debate. Now, a few quotes I think will give you really good perspective and context of thunder to really understand her and let her soak into you. And this one is from, yes, Hal Tassig and Celine Lilly from their book, The Thunder Perfect Mind, A New Translation and Introduction. Let me quote it for you. It goes, "Thunder is full of humor, exaggeration, and subversion. It constantly disorients and reorients its audience. It sets up expectation and then turns them so that moving through its image feels like a walk through the house of mirrors. Indeed, in the unpredictable spaces of both thunder and a house of mirrors, sections of the self are warped and multiplied, recast and denaturalized with fantastical effects. To be sure, performing thunder means carrying out a set of strategic destructions. It means being at a loss for who you are and where you belong. Calculated amnesia in a reality saturated with forceful reminders of who and how one should, quote, be at every moment." Excellent quote. And we have another excellent quote by Elaine Pagel. She offered this in an interview with PBS when discussing Thunder Perfect Mind. It goes, "Thunder Perfect Mind is a marvelous, strange poem. It speaks in the voice of a feminine divine power, but one that unites all opposites, one that is not only speaking in women, but also in all people. One that speaks not only in citizens, but aliens. It says, in the poor and in the rich. It is a poem which sees the radiance of the divine in all aspects of human life, from the sordidness of the slums of Cairo or Alexandria, as they would have been, to the people of great wealth, from men to women to slaves. In that poem, the divine appears in every and the most unexpected forms. Thunder Perfect Mind may have been written in Egypt. It's probably written by somebody who knows the traditions of Isis, knows the traditions of the Jews. It shows that this movement grew up in a world in which Jewish, Egyptian, Greek, Roman traditions are mingled and mixing and well known to many sophisticated people. All you had to do is travel around a city like Karnak, and you saw these images and these various religions and these various cultures mixing." So great quote by Elaine herself. Now let's move into the spiritual or the spirituality of thunder. Let me get a little drink here first. All right. Spiritual exercises. Now, the obvious one is you can take thunder as a meditative / artistic text, something you can recite, meditate upon, incorporate in your art, whatever you need to do. Write some music to it if you want, or write your own version of it. That's pretty much obvious. But speaking of versions, this is an exercise that I have tried. I call it that you are everywhere. Now, basically, again, thunder is in control. Thunder is victorious. But she is basically doing what I say in the Finding Hermes podcast. She is laying all her cards down on the table. She is saying, this is me in totality. Everything that's happened to me makes me, and that's where I transcend, and it all happens in one point in time. And again, I've done this for myself. I've, for example, said, I am Miguel, I am the man, I am the father, I am the podcaster. I once wrote a big science fiction novel. I was once a drug addict who betrayed people. I am this, I am that. And without judgment and without attachment, I will start naming all these things. I'll close my eyes and I'll start saying all these things. And I'll simply tell myself, this is not happening in the past or the future. This is one point of time that is this entity called Miguel, just like there is this entity called Thunder. And that's where the victory is, because when we accept ourselves, when we integrate everything that we are, that's when we are victorious over the world. That's when we are supreme, because who we are has meaning. Our mere presence as a full being is part of the cosmic order, and at the same transcends the cosmic order. And again, it's a great meditative tool to understand that the totality of you is great. There's no shame in everything you have done. Thunder herself has went through horrible things, just as Eve goes through brutal raping and other horrors by the archons in the Gnostic Gospels. But it doesn't matter. These things are part of them. These things must be integrated. They must be faced. And these things are part of a bigger order. Who we are and everything we've done has meaning by the simple fact that we have existed, and we need to simply acknowledge that we exist and we matter. So I would try that yourself. It's worked out for me. The other one is obviously a call to the downtrodden. Again, Thunder speaks to everybody. She is speaking to those at the edge of town, to those in the alleys. She speaks to everything. She is truly an egalitarian divinity. And I think Thunder is a great reminder that we must help those who are lost, those who have less. We must remind them that they matter, that their totality has meaning in this universe, and they are part of the divine order and the divine plan and the cosmic order of this world. So keeping Thunder as always a reminder to help, as I say in the show, the least of our brothers is important. And that is the essence of Thunder, and really the essence of this rejected wisdom, Sophia, bar below Eve, that no matter how many times she is rejected, she's always there to help those of us who have fallen on the road, those of us who need her gifts, those of us who need to be washed by her beautiful tears. The last one is kind of new. I call it Voice of Thunder. Now, this was happening early July. I was actually doing research on this presentation. And suddenly there was a lot of storms. It was July 4th weekend. And in Northern Illinois, it is rare that it rains. But as I was working on this presentation, storm after storm kept coming. And I'm sitting there in my own head writing stuff. And I said, oh my God, there is thunder outside. Wow. So, and then I thought, you know what? Whenever there's thunder, all of nature listens. Every person, animal, and insect listens to thunder because they know that change is coming. They know that the natural order, which thunder sits outside, is going to change. Maybe for the good, nicer weather, there'll be water for the crops, but it could be for the worse. There could be powerful storms and the trees are uprooted and entire ecosystems are destroyed. But regardless, when thunder talks, everybody listens. So what I did is I went outside while I stood in the porch, underneath the porch. I closed my eyes, and every time there was a thunder, I said, what are you saying to me, goddess? What are you saying to me, Sophia? And I'd hear the thunder, and I didn't project. I didn't say, like, the thunder was saying, you know, Miguel, you need to lose 10 pounds or something. No, I made sure that I did not project. I said, what do you want me to say? And the thunder and the lightning and everything sort of stirred, and I felt it stirring within me. And these wonderful wordless realizations kept coming up with me, kept coming up to me and in my mind. And now whenever there's a storm of thunder, I do that. I close my eyes, I stand outside, and I just listen to thunder and try to let what the voice is trying to tell me, because that's probably what she sounds. For you could do that, or you could do something, and please make sure you're safe, make sure the lightning's not close to you, but go outside in the rain, Let it soak to you. Let the winds whip at you and just recite thunder, perfect mind in the rain, and just dance and connect with nature and the natural order of the cosmos. So those are four, you might say, meditations that I have tried that have worked for me for the better. If you have any of your own, please share tonight or in time, because again, thunder, perfect mind is for everyone. It is the true text of equality, probably one of the greatest examples ever, and probably Isis might be probably right up there. So as we're getting to the end, sources, yes, I highly recommend Hal Tosic with Celine Lilly and other great scholars, Nicola Denze Lewis and her work on Introduction to Gnosticism, and Birger Pearson, his book Ancient Gnosticism, has a great section on, yes, thunder, perfect mind. Dr. David Litt was good, and there are others that I probably meant. Robert Price, of course. Again, you have the links to these articles. So why don't we get into some questions? And I'm sure the question you're asking right now is, who is that? Well, that's Alanis Morissette from her video, You Oughta Know. And I'm going to tell you that might be the perfect example. And why is that? Because when this song and album came out in 1995, it literally changed the psyche of Western people. There was a time when one out of three people owned this album. And it was really a powerful cry. She wasn't angry. Like thunder, she was powerful. And if you listen to Alanis Morissette's songs, they have this paradoxical thing, like in You Oughta Know or Hand in Pocket or these songs. She's talking about how she's humiliated, but she's victorious, how she's done wrong things, but she's happy. So I think Alanis Morissette in that Jagged Little Pill really exemplified thunder. And again, that album really helped. I think it did more for feminism than feminists did in the 90s. It was really a groundbreaking work and really tapped into the idea of thunder. It was part of that confessional genre of women, where women weren't just like, I'm in love or I hate men. They were just saying, this is my trauma. This is what I did right. This is my spirituality. This is my, they were just laying their cards on the table. And there's probably no coincidence that the 90s is the highest selling time for women singers in the history of mankind. I mean, people were buying female singers like they were hotcakes, because women were, they were being complete, like Alanis Morissette. So that's a little side note. So I hope you like it, and let me know if you have any questions or comments.
What do you think of that line in the last stanza where it says, I alone exist and have no one to judge me? ¶¶